Public Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kalb, and I'm pleased to have today my guest, Dr. Donald Light, who is the editor of The Risk of Prescription Drugs. I was very pleased to read this book. As many of you know, I gave a lecture at the Truth Convention on the FDA and covered everything except prescription drugs. Not that prescription drugs aren't important, it's just that there was an hour limit on my lecture, so I was covering implants and food and other cosmetics. But certainly I have a great interest in this, and I just really enjoyed this book. I thought it was well-researched, and also the different categories of problems were well-presented, and then at the end, suggestions for solving these problems were also well-presented. Thanks very much for joining us, Donald. Where are you calling in from?
Well, it's a real pleasure to talk with you, and I'm calling from Princeton, New Jersey.
Oh, great. My brother went to Princeton, so I've been up there.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Right.
So you are a professor. Are you currently at the University of Medicine and Dentistry of New Jersey, or are you...
Yes. I'm a professor of comparative health policy at...
Okay.
The University of Medicine and Dentistry of New Jersey, and a visiting researcher at Princeton. And this book, this slim book, I think it's probably the smallest, cheapest book that Columbia University Press produces, it was commissioned by the MacArthur Foundation in Chicago to be for general readers, so it's a short, non-technical book, to alert them to a whole area of risks that a lot of them don't know about, and then other volumes in the series are about other kinds of risks, but this one is about the often hidden harms by prescription drugs. And what amazed me was that most new drugs have few benefits over existing drugs, so there are often no offsetting benefits for the risks, and newer drugs have greater risks because they're under-tested for safety. In fact, I one thing I haven't got to the bottom of is how the FDA can approve so many new drugs, about 85% of all new drugs, as safe and effective when the trials are run by companies, and the companies understandably design the trials to minimize evidence of harmful side effects because they want to have their drugs approved. So there's a great conflict of interest there. But it means the FDA doesn't have that much information about safety issues when it reviews the final portfolio.
Now, it's important for our listeners to understand, and they may not realize this, but the patents on drugs run out after 7 years. Is that correct?
Well, the patents are 20 years from the date of patent, and the industry says that there are 7 years remaining. But that's part of their rhetoric about how the patents really should be 25 years. And also their claim is the longer patents and other market protections are, the more wonderful new drugs we'll have. And what strikes me is that while that's the rhetoric, the reality is pretty clear. There's a consistent pattern that independent review bodies find that about 85% or 5 out of every 6 new drugs approved actually have a few or no advantages over existing drugs. So basically patents are used to develop a lot of new products that then they can sell that don't actually improve clinical life for patients who have illnesses and problems.
So for our listening audience, basically what happens is a patent is applied for, there's a certain amount of research and development done before, and then there's a time period that clinical studies are done. There's phase 1, 2, and 3 trials, clinical trials that then the FDA reviews, and then the drug comes to market. And the industry is saying that with all that process, they only have the drug out on average 7 years before it becomes generic, and then, of course, they lose their profit margin on it because the generic companies start making it. But in actuality, you're saying it's actually usually longer than that because there's...
Well, let me sort of throw in a few reasons why this kind of standard story is somewhat mythic. So that story leaves out all the ways in which the teams of patent lawyers working with companies find ways of patenting another aspect of a drug later on, and then patent another one. It's called evergreening, and each time they add another patent, that's another 20 years. So it's not as if, you know, you apply for the patent and you go through 13 years of testing and there are only 7 years left. They also, studies of patent patterns have found that a number of drugs have the patents applied for later. And, of course, the advantage of that is that then the patent lasts much longer. So there's all kinds of gaming around patents by clever patent lawyers, and how long a drug. and then also there are quite a few drugs that generic companies don't immediately produce as generics, and there are other kinds of ways in which companies can extend the monopoly pricing period. Even when generic companies apply to try to put a competing drug on the market. So it's not a foregone conclusion that as soon as the first patent is finished, then the price will drop. It might or might not.
Might not, right. And it's important, as pointed out in your book, that the majority of new drugs are not compared against the drugs they're replacing that are going generic.
Yeah, that's an amazing part of the story that most people don't know. I think most of my neighbors think that new drugs are developed to be better than existing drugs. Why else would they be developed? And
right.
And that they're tested to be better. Well, that's not true. In fact, the FDA requires that the drugs be compared to placebo, that is an inert substance, and so when they prove quote better unquote, it's better than nothing, as it were.
Right.
And in fact, the FDA is prohibited from commenting on how much better or worse a new drug is than existing drugs, and that you know kind of works against patients and doctors.
Mm-hmm.
So it
sure does, because the doctor really doesn't have any idea whether or not the extra cost or the extra copay, since most people have insurance, and it's just a matter of what tier they're going to pay. Are they going to pay $4, you know, $10, or $60,
yes,
depending on what tier you're in?
Right, and then even aside from price, I mean, even if they were all free or they all cost the same amount, you know, aside
right.
from price. There have been a number of important articles by people who run trials, or experts about trials, who point out that these kinds of trials don't give clinicians very useful information because they don't provide comparative information about how a given new drug compares to other drugs that a doctor might prescribe. So
right.
there's very little helpful prescribing information even just on a straight clinical basis.
And to emphasize how important this is, the cardiologist we use all the time was part of the All-Hat study, which was interesting. So I knew quite a bit about that. Would you like to tell our listeners why All-Hat was so important?
Oh, I think you probably know more than I do.
I
should say that I'm trained as an organizational sociologist, so I have no training in medicine or pharmacy.
Well, what did it show, though?
Biology,
it showed something very important.
I basically am looking at, and this book is pulling together what I've learned as someone who studies whole industries and their relationship to society. And it seems to me that the tacit contract or understanding between society and drug companies has really fallen down, because we're getting so many new drugs that experts judge are little or no better, but have produced a lot of harm. So prescription drugs are now the fourth leading cause of death, and they're producing about 20 to 40 million adverse drug reactions a year, and about 1.5 million hospitalizations. So this is an epidemic pattern, a very large-scale pattern. And even the medically minor adverse drug reactions, like getting sleepy or having muscle pain or having a slower reaction, can be quite dangerous, even though they're not medically serious. For example, there was an article this summer in the New York Times identifying prescription drugs as a major cause of auto accidents and trucking accidents. Now, truckers taking something to keep them going on their demanding schedules, and then their reaction time is slowed down, or they get a bit sleepy or out of focus, and then bang, there's an accident. I think the reason why this book is so important for people to look at is that we have this epidemic that's actually caused by the drugs we take to get better, uh-huh. and we don't know about that.
Yeah, the whole thing with the comparison. I believe that there was one study that showed that the correct use of prescription medication was the fourth leading cause of death in the U.S.
Yeah, that's study? Our book, right? Yeah, that's a key part of the overview. And we have something we call the risk proliferation syndrome, which is a set of institutional practices that actually proliferates the use of drugs that have few advantages but risks of harms. And one of them that really struck me was about the military. You know, there were reports earlier this year in February and actually even in March about the extraordinary number of our soldiers who are given combination psychotropic drugs that are that have disturbing side effects and lead them to go crazy or attempt suicide or whatever. And then antipsychotics are being used very widely, on one hand in children who are not psychotic, and there's a very low rate of psychosis amongst children, and also amongst elderly in nursing homes and residential homes.
Almost just to sedate or just to keep them from being problematic.
Yes, but these are much more powerful than sleeping pills, and they have serious side effects. Those are examples of what's called off-label use. And one thing that I think people don't realize is that off-label, it sounds kind of cute. It sounds like you're doing something that your mother wouldn't want you to do, a little bit risque, off-label. But off-label uses really are uses that are not approved by the FDA. So and companies are prohibited from marketing for unapproved uses, but they get a whole army of clinicians who are paid to promote unapproved uses for them, and that
right.
is legal.
That's true. Doctors can use off-label. There's nothing
pardon again?
No problem with it, other than it might be a little bit more risky legally, but. Off-label usage is allowed per doctors.
Oh, it's allowed. Yeah, doctors are allowed to prescribe for anything.
Right.
But companies are not allowed to market for
That's
uses
correct.
Of a drug that have not been approved.
So they just hire doctors to go around and talk at dinners with a bunch of other doctors about their off-label uses.
Yeah.
That's what they do. Mm-hmm. Very common.
And one of the other ways in which the use of prescription drugs has proliferated is by the creation of new risks and actually whole new disease categories that haven't existed before. An interesting one that we all are aware of is cholesterol. So we all talk about our cholesterol these days, but 20 years ago, no one really knew what their cholesterol was. And,
right.
And it's
never
turning
treated.
Out that cholesterol is a substitute measure for risk of heart disease and heart attacks. But the evidence has been growing in the last couple of years that the whole theory behind high cholesterol, that lowering your cholesterol will lower the chances of dying, is not true if you are asymptomatic, if you're not already at risk of heart disease.
Right.
If you are, it is helpful. But that means that about 70% of the people taking statins don't really need to take them. But it's all been based on using cholesterol as a surrogate or substitute measure of heart disease.
Right, and like you say in the book, doctors are much more interested in lowering your cholesterol than they are in telling you to eat correctly and exercise and quit smoking and the types of things that lower risk factors that are known to be associated with heart attack.
Yeah, and the 630 ads have ways of handling that. So there's this one character who says, "Well, I thought that exercising and eating right would take care of my cholesterol. Boy, was I wrong!" And then it goes into marketing the drug, and and the answer is maybe in his case he was wrong, and it can be that he's wrong, but it isn't as if it's generally wrong.
Right,
it's kind of a quick way of dismissing the sound ways of lowering cholesterol. Another one there's a short chapter in the book on the medicalization of sadness and loss and anxiety and emotions like that, and the tremendous proliferation of antidepressants, the creation of anti-anxiety as a medical disorder.
Social anxiety.
The SSRI drugs, as they're called, were based on another theory that has proven not to be correct, but has been promoted for almost 25 years, and that is the serotonin theory of depression.
Right.
But it turns out that serotonin levels are not terribly correlated with major depression.
And, well, like many things, high cholesterol, sadness, anxiety, there's many, many causes for these end symptoms. And I interviewed Dr. Amen, who wrote a book called Healing Depression and Anxiety, and he used a functional scan called a spectra scan and, did the scan on all these people with anxiety and depression and determined that there were 7 different categories. And what was interesting is that many teenagers had the category where the temporal lobes were involved in the spectra scan. And he was able to determine scientifically why giving these people Prozac would increase their risk of suicide. Isn't that interesting?
Mm.
And it did, of course.
Yeah.
That was the group that had the high risk of suicide when given the SSRI inhibitors. So really what I think is we need to learn a lot more about what causes these things that we're measuring, be it anxiety, depression, high cholesterol, whatever it is. It's a lot more complicated than one pill is going to fix everybody with that symptom.
Yeah, so just to clarify, there are sort of 2 basic categories of measurements here. Actual clinical outcomes, like if you have a fever, your temperature goes down, or if it's something like risk of heart disease, a clinical outcome would be a heart attack or some other cardiac traumatic event, as opposed to substitute measures that are called surrogate endpoints, like having your cholesterol go down, which turns out isn't the same thing at all. And so that's one of the simple, important things that could be done and is being done in certain places, and that is that the requirement that all clinical trials measure the effectiveness of new drugs against clinical endpoints, against changes in actual clinical illness or pain or infection or whatever the clinical problem is, not against substitute measures.
Well, that probably isn't going over real well with the drug companies.
Well, it's happening increasingly in Europe. So because Europe is organized into larger payers or buyers, they're increasingly demanding evidence that new drugs are clinically better against clinical endpoints. And so this change is occurring more rapidly there. But the United States is, ironically, becoming the guinea pig for new drugs. So more new drugs are first approved in the United States based on these on company-designed and run trials that are designed to maximize evidence that drugs are effective against often substitute measures, and to minimize evidence that they're harmful, and then it's American patients who first take the drugs. So I think we have something to worry about here. And one rule of thumb that a number of physicians have recommended is: don't take any drug that's been on the market for less than 5 years. Unless you have to. Now, there are patients who do have to. They've tried everything else, and they're really in a corner, and they have a serious condition.
Or something unique is coming out that was never developed.
Pardon? But you're the physician.
There are
tell me, what do you think?
For pulmonary hypertension, stuff like, you know, diagnoses that aren't very common.
Mm-hmm.
So... yeah, I agree.
What,
I think that 5 years is about what it takes to bring out all these risk. And I don't know that the public understands why the same risks do not come out in the clinical trials, but if they could see the size of the clinical trials and the length, they'd realize that they're very short and not that many people.
Yes, this little book, The Risks of Prescription Drugs, has a section that specifies the various strategies used to design trials in a biased way. So one way that you just mentioned is running the trial short enough that it picks up evidence of the main benefit, but not long enough to pick up the evidence of side effects, which often take a little longer to become evident. And I'm not talking here about rare side effects or long-term side effects, because no reasonable trial can pick up either rare side effects or long-term ones. But
right. But
as you say, if the trials are only a few weeks rather than a few months, or a few months rather than many months, depending on the drug,
that's
one way.
That's like when they had the 5-year trials for breast implants. That was kind of hilarious, because the engineering data from Dow Corning showed that the silastic shell would start to break down at 8 to 15 years, depending on the manufacturer. So they knew that when they designed the trial. It's kind of like the cigarette trials, you know, only looking at smokers for 5 years and saying, well, smoking doesn't cause lung cancer.
Right. Yeah. Well, so given that a lot of us are being prescribed drugs that we're supposed to take forever, what the industry calls a lifer, sort of sounds like somebody with a life sentence, but anyway, one of the implications of that is that the FDA and we all really want to have those drugs evaluated over 5, 10, or 15 years because we're taking the drugs for 5, 10, or 15 years. That's not all drugs, but there are drugs that
take. And I think we need to know a lot more about functional medicine, like the statins decrease the production of or cause a deficiency of coenzyme Q10 in a lot of patients, and if they take coenzyme Q10, a lot of the side effects can be averted. So really looking at functional medicine and COX-2 inhibitors that were way, way too good a pathway blocker were the ones that were associated with a lot more severe side effects.
Yeah.
But whenever you block a pathway entirely, yes, the drug works better, but your side effects, if the drug is taken for a long enough time, are going to be more significant. So actually taking a look at functional medicine and seeing what, you can probably predict what's going to happen over time if you understood how the drug interacted with functional pathways.
Mm-hmm. I came across a pair of articles in December about painkillers, studies that compared the what are called the COXIBs, the like Vioxx. Well, Vioxx is off the market now, but
Bobic, Celebrex, yeah.
Celebrex, and so forth, and with the narcotics like codeine and
mm-hmm.
and drugs that have oxycodone in them.
Right.
With the non-steroid anti-inflammatories like Advil and Aleve. And
mm-hmm.
some of the old and cheaper ones, Advil, Aleve, and Motrin, were much safer, and the narcotics were surprisingly dangerous,
mm-hmm.
increasing the risk of death, according to these studies.
Because of tolerance and overdose and sedation, mm-hmm. probably. Driving.
Right.
Hazards.
Right.
Said earlier. Well, you pointed out well in the book that Vioxx was supposed to be a benefit over Motrin by decreasing gastrointestinal bleeding, and I believe it did that. However, mm-hmm. it substituted a much more dangerous risk of heart attack and stroke.
Yeah. So there's a famous pair of graphs in the book that shows the increased risk of heart attack or sudden death or cardiac trauma next to the decreasing risk for gastrointestinal bleed. And as was summarized, I think it was in the New England Journal of Medicine, essentially the trade-off was one less gastrointestinal bleed for a heart attack, which is hardly
yeah, right.
the trade-off that
throw the dice and take your chances,
was presenting. And there's a really striking report by Congressman Henry Waxman and his staff of the Merck marketing materials that shows that each time there was a public announcement of the risk of Vioxx, Merck redoubled its campaign and advertising to affirm how safe it was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a couple of instances in the book where you show how the drug companies spin these reports to their favor. I guess it's a real
mm-hmm.
art. To take hard scientific evidence and make it appear like the opposite. But they have a lot of money. You know, they have a lot of money to spend on public opinion.
Well, there's a fairly new report that came out just a couple of months ago on the rapidly increasing criminal and civil monetary penalties that companies have paid, and I'm actually reading from it, about almost $20 billion of penalties paid out in the last 20 years, and three-quarters of those have occurred in just the past 5 years. So we have some really serious misbehavior, and that included illegal off-label promotion that I mentioned earlier, and withholding information about safety problems, as well as other kinds of charges. And in each case, the companies claim, they usually claim no wrongdoing, but then they pay a huge penalty anyway.
Here's one off the news, September 1st, 2010. Allergan, the maker of Botox, agreed to pay $600 million and plead guilty to a misdemeanor.
Yeah.
So that's $600 right. million of your $2 billion. Is it $2
billion? It's $20 billion over the last 20 years.
$20 billion. Okay, so we've got to get a lot more than just Botox, huh?
Well, it
that
sounds
was a big
like
one
awful
in plastic
lot to pay
surgery,
for misdemeanor,
though.
I must say.
I'm sorry?
Paying $600 million for misdemeanor, did you say $600
million? $600 million and guilty to a misdemeanor.
Yeah, that strikes me as
isn't that interesting?
Funny.
I just looked it up on Google because I couldn't remember the exact amount, but I was kind of floored by the fine. That was amazing. But I guess
well,
$600 million is not that much money compared to what they make on Botox.
Is a strange part of it. That I mean, clearly there was various serious allegations that would lead the company to have to pay such a very large fine.
Well, Botox was only approved in the glabellar area, which is between the eyebrows, and doctors were using it off-label a lot of other places, you know, and some were okay and some weren't, you know, like it just depends on where you use it and whether or not it was a good idea to relax that muscle. But I think that they're reps for Botox were encouraging that, so probably very aggressively. So that was that was what that fine was about. But it was a misdemeanor, according to the to the news report. So I don't know for sure. I just know I was as a plastic surgeon. That one caught my attention.
Yeah. One of the chapters is on the medicalization of women. It focuses on the hormone replacement therapy case and the way in which menopause was portrayed by industry-supported clinicians as a kind of deterioration that increased risk of cancer and heart disease unless patients took hormone replacement therapy. And then when HRT was finally tested in a thorough and objective way, it turned out it was the hormone replacement therapy that increased risk of cancer and heart disease, as I understand it. But there are other examples of the ways in which women have been a target. I've read that Yasmin and Yaz, the birth control. Mm-hmm. Pills have some substantial risks. I'm not sure that everyone's
well,
aware.
Well, just about any estrogen-based medication will increase risk of heart attack and blood clots, especially if you smoke.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I know they try to, minimize that, but in actuality, mm-hmm. that's always been the case. So I guess Yasmin and Yaz are, I think they're under the gun because of blood clots and the associated pulmonary embolus, I would imagine.
Yeah, well, it's really great that you're a highly trained physician because you know much more about these things than I do with that.
And I'm an old physician, too. You know, I'm like almost 57 years old, so I lived through all this. Back when I was being trained, high cholesterol wasn't a problem. Unless it was genetically so high that your blood was, a different consistency. And then we knew it was a problem. But those were the only people that got treated.
Right.
So, but, you know, it's interesting because in my career, it has been amazing to me at how many drugs have been taken off the market after FDA approval. There's a couple of things that are just incredible. It's just the sheer numbers of drugs. And I think your book alludes to that fact, too, that just a huge number of drugs got pulled off the market fairly soon after being released. And then the thing that that really floored me, and you may have gone to press before this came out, was that Darvon products got removed from the from general use. And that drug was in use for, 38 years or something?
Yes. Yeah,
I mean that's amazing.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. Well, the studies that I've found indicate that about one out of every five new drugs ends up causing enough serious harm to warrant a black box warning, or be withdrawn, or have some serious response to it. And then there's been some rigorous studies done. Showing that the shorter the review time, the more likely are drugs to be approved that will later be seriously harmful to patients. And
which makes
this
sense.
Has occurred since the industry started financing the FDA. So basically, I don't know if listeners are aware of this, but since 1992, companies have substantially paid for the review of their own drugs. So they're not only paying and designing their own trials, but then they're financing the branch of the FDA that reviews new drugs to decide whether the drug should be approved. That's kind of a clear, straightforward conflict of interest, it seems to me, but aside from
wasn't that
opinion,
brought about
it
because the approval
the
process was way too slow?
Pardon?
Didn't that occur though? That was a bill that was passed because the approval
yes.
process was way too slow for the company.
Well, the question is, what is way too slow? So the industry claimed it was way too slow,
right?
And there were cases that were extraordinarily slow, but the question is whether safety comes first, and whether if there are questions about a drug, whether taking longer is somehow quote too slow. So it's a matter of point of view. From the point of view of the company, it's very frustrating because they are losing money and running up costs. But the length of review has a fair amount to do with the companies as well. So there are detailed studies that show how companies would be slow in responding to questions from reviewers.
Right.
And then there are also cases where companies themselves would take a drug out from review for a while and then put it back into review. So if you just take the total time, it may be misleading. Because the company plays a pretty important role about how quickly it responds and whether it sort of takes a time out from the reviewing process.
Right, and whether they actually answer the questions that the reviewers are asking. And
of course,
seems
the famous thalidomide case. Sorry, what?
Oh, you said in the book that some of the companies were trying to get the reviewers shifted to other reviewers too.
Oh, yes. Well, there have been quite a few studies showing that in various cases, FDA managers and some more senior people will shift a critical reviewer off a drug or will not allow the reviewer to be at critical meetings, which raises some real questions about how the FDA is operating and whether it's in the hands of the industry. because it hires these very dedicated and highly trained PhDs to do this reviewing. And then if a reviewer is worried about a drug causing serious harm, you would think the regulator would pay a lot of attention to that. And sometimes they do, and sometimes they don't seem to. I was mentioning thalidomide because, you know, the sort of famous heroic case in the United States is about a drug where the reviewer did take a lot of time reviewing because she continued to have concerns about the safety of this drug that had been approved in Europe and was widely used in Europe, and there was all this pressure from the companies and elsewhere to get this drug on the market so that women could benefit from them. And then as she had her doubts and kept asking for better data and more data, reports came in of deformed babies with flipper limbs or no limbs at all, and just you know, horrifying cases, and also babies that were stillborn dead, and because of her insistence on having clear evidence of safety and assuring herself that there weren't serious risks, American women were saved from taking this drug, and then it started being withdrawn from every country.
Which brings us to the approval process in other countries like Europe. Is mm-hmm. it now more rigorous or less rigorous than it was at the time?
I would say it's less rigorous. One reason is that the European Medicines Agency, known as EMEA, but anyway, the FDA counterpart, doesn't have nearly the number of highly trained expert reviewers, and it depends much more on the company's presentation of its trials. So the FDA is actually in a much stronger position and has a much more substantial staff to review. But EMEA is moving towards demanding more comparative trial evidence, more evidence that new drugs are better than existing drugs, and that's making it harder.
Well, the FDA Science Board presented a report, I believe it was in 2006 or somewhere around there, that the FDA really wasn't able to effectively do its job because of all of these deficiencies, you know, inability to keep up with the science and
yes.
All of the, there was a whole list of reasons why they couldn't do their job, mainly because
yes.
everything was getting so much more complex. And this is beyond just prescription drugs. This has to do with nanotechnology, genetically modified foods, you know. The FDA is charged with protecting the food supply as well as cosmetic and personal care products
yes.
and a huge number of other things. It actually spends most of its time just working on prescription drugs. Over-the-counter drugs are supposed to be regulated. So, you know, it was the conclusion of the FDA Science Board that the FDA just simply cannot do its job. So what do you think the solutions are? I mean, where do we need to go from here?
Well, I think we all really need to realize that every drug has side effects, and that if most new drugs are little or no better than existing drugs, then there is really very little offsetting benefit. So we need a strong FDA that is independently funded. One way of funding it would be just to have a small surcharge on every prescription. Like, I mean, let's say there was 50 cents or a dollar per prescription that went to assuring the public that drugs were really safe. And then the FDA, I think, clearly needs to change its rules so that it does have companies test drugs against
existing drugs.
Existing drugs and against hard clinical endpoints. And there are a number of
and,
people
and maybe
who have
the company doesn't
for,
need to do the testing.
The
maybe the testing
to
needs to be done
publicly
in
funded
facility.
Because there's no way that companies are going to design and run trials that aren't in their favor. And so this is also happening in some other countries where independent funding means that the design of the trials is much more rigorous, and patients and doctors get much better information about how to prescribe appropriately.
Yeah, I think independent studies are extremely important, and funding needs to be separated so that it can't be withdrawn when the findings aren't what the industry wants. I think if you take a look at the cellular telephone studies that Carlo did, Dr. Carlo, uh-huh. I interviewed him on the radio show, and he wrote a mm-hmm. book on what happened to him when he was mm-hmm. finding that wireless and cellular telephones and the electromagnetic things that we're exposed to can actually increase neuroepithelial malignancies and acoustic neuromas. They basically, even though it was an independent study, they basically were able to destroy the study, and his house mysteriously burnt down, and he had to go underground, and you know, just an amazing story about what happens when the findings aren't what the industry wants them to be. So, that's a problem for scientists too. I mean, if the scientists are going to engage in studies and then, you know, be having to go underground, that's a problem. You know. Depending on what they find. That's a real problem. And that was an independent study. That the cell phone industry was funding that through FDA oversight. So the system's
you're so experienced. What do you think would be good things to do to make drugs safer and more effective?
Well, in my book, The Naked Truth About Breast Implants, I talk about an independent study, research facilities funded not just by the drug companies or industry in the case of, you know, other, it's not just pharmaceuticals, obviously. So it has to be partly public funds, maybe partly, like you say, mm-hmm. surcharges on things, partly industry, mm-hmm. but it goes into a fund where it can't be withdrawn if somebody doesn't mm-hmm. like the results of the study. And I suggest using something that you may not have really thought about, but in my experience, a lot of the potential problems can probably be predicted through intuitive and clairvoyant means. And so using people with high levels of those skills to look at what is hidden. For example, I have many, many instances of people who are highly gifted in the intuitive skills, being able to predict a side effect of a drug class before it actually came forward. And so we need to gather that kind of information and then design studies to look for it, or look for it in the clinical trials. And if there's going to be a problem, I was talking with one of the intuitives from Canada who said the silicone breast implants had just gone back in the market in 2006, and shortly thereafter I was interviewing her on the Temple of Health radio show, and she uh-huh. said, they're going to come back off the market in a few years because they're going to react to something in the food supply. Well, about that time I had 5 patients that were eating lunch meat every day, and they had silicone mm-hmm. throughout their body because they had ruptured implants, and all 5 of them developed Morgellons disease. At the same time, Hildegard Staninger, a toxicologist, was measuring the fibers in Morgellons disease and found that they were high-density polyethylene and silicone. Well, high-density polyethylene was being sprayed on lunch meat to prevent listeria infections. Being sprayed around a viral phage to prevent listeria infections. There's no labeling requirements for it. Mm-hmm. And then I called the CDC about it, and they actually sent the head of the Morgellons division out here to see her first case of Morgellons in my clinic. But you see, a clairvoyant who knew nothing about anything, I mean nothing, she doesn't know anything about breast implants, she knows absolutely nothing about nanotechnology, she said silicone implants are going to be taken off the market because they're going to react to something in the food supply. What do you think of that?
Wow.
That's pretty amazing.
That's quite a story. Yeah.
It's quite a story, and it's not the only one. I think as we get more proficient in accessing higher levels of what, you know, we might want to call universal mind or whatever you want to call it, we can learn what we need to be looking out for. You know, and also the time frames in which this occurs. I happen to have about 2,000 patients with problems with their silicone implants, so I have a large clinical group to, you know, and then I pay attention to patterns. But you know, basically with clinical medicine, you have to see a large group of people before you're going to see the patterns jump out at you.
Yeah.
Mm. Like, for example, just about all the patients in my, I've been doing this 26 years, most of the patients, except maybe one or two who died from silicone, died of a very unusual aggressive lymphoma. And then a paper came out that said that there was one brand of implant, textured implant specifically, that was made with a lost salt technique, and one of the manufacturers used that and the others didn't. And the majority of the cases were associated with this one brand of textured implant made with lost salt technique. And there was a lot of evidence of that, but when the FDA issued their statement, it says, oh, it's very rare, unusual cancer, hardly occurs ever at all if you consider all of the people who've ever gotten breast implants and only the 60 cases we found. Well, I didn't report any of my cases. You know, I mean, I got a phone call from the husband saying that, you know, the patient died of an aggressive lymphoma, you know. So that's how things are whitewashed. That's how things are. I mean, you know very well as a scientist that you can make things one way or another depending on, if you know all the variables and all of the different things, you can design studies to show whatever you want.
Yeah.
If you know something doesn't occur for 10 years, design the study for 5 years. I mean, I was a researcher at Hopkins and at Washington University. I know how to design a study. You tell me what you want to see, I'll design it for you. I mean, I stepped out of the research.
Oh, what would be most helpful for listeners, do you think?
Read your book, The Risk of Prescription Drugs. This is a very, very good book.
It's only $15 on Amazon, or maybe even less by now. So,
do you have any contact information for the book itself? Is there a website?
Just the Amazon webpage.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what we run an integrative medical clinic here. Millennium Healthcare is our integrative medical clinic, and we would recommend that people take, other than hormone replacements and other replacement medication, which really aren't drugs because they're replacing what you don't have, insulin, that kind of thing, we would recommend that you try not to take medications for a long period of time, you know, if you can avoid it. Or if you do take the older
ones. There's also a website on the Columbia University Press website. There's a web page there on the book as well. Well, it's really been great having you as an interviewer, having such a knowledgeable and experienced person, and I hope this has been interesting to listeners as well.
Well, thank you so much for coming on. I've really enjoyed talking to you, and like I said, this really fills in that the rest of the FDA lecture that I didn't address prescription drugs, but I will use a lot of the information in your book because it's so well done and the history is so well done. And I appreciate you joining us.
Well, thank you.
Well, I wanted to do a few announcements. Next week, of course, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, myself, Dr. Gould, and Dr. Greenberg are going to be speaking at the Global Health and Humanitarian Summit at Emory University. Dr. Shulman, who is the creator of Patch Adams and Doc Hollywood, will be giving the opening on Friday evening. We'll be speaking along with Norm Shealy. Dr. Shealy's the founder of Holistic Medicine. Burton Goldberg, who was the editor of Alternative Medicine for many years, the head of the HeartMath Institute, head of the Monroe Institute, among others, will be speaking on Saturday and Sunday from noon to 5. That's a free conference at Emory University. And then Patch Adams will be giving the closing ceremonies Sunday night. So that's a great event. It's meant to be a festival. There'll be a lot of things for the kids to do. Then I will be giving a live interview online with Andrea on the 7th of April. We will, on the 9th of April, we will be interviewing Dr. Stephen Greer. He's an ER doctor who's the head of the Disclosure Project. He has fascinating information about what the government's covering up. His book is called Hidden Truth, Forbidden Knowledge. I can tell you personally, I was at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base for 4 years, and I can tell you that stuff was going on there that was covered up. And so read his book to learn about that. And then Larry Flaxman and Marie Jones will be on the 16th, 11-11, the time prop phenomena, all about time-space continuum and what you need to know about that with what's coming up. Then biochemical imbalances and disease, Lorraine Nicole and Ann Woodruff Bairn are the editors of that. It's one of the best books. It's actually a textbook on biochemical imbalances of disease, more for the medical profession, but it's a great resource. And then Noetic Science Meeting will be on Thursday, April 21st at 7:15 at the Georgetown Square Dunwoody location. Leigh Culver will be our guest speaker, and he will be discussing UFOs, extra-biological entities, and their interactions with human beings. Leigh is a remote viewer who has worked with the government, who's worked with Russia extensively, and has, including the International Society for UFO Research in Moscow, and is a fascinating speaker. He's returning here speaking for a second time. Anyway, this is Dr. Susan Kolb, Temple of Health Radio Show. Please join us next week.